This episode is brought to you by UiPath. Human achievement can be slow. 200,000 years to go from the wheel to your jalopy? Really? But today, 90% of the Fortune 500 are accelerating human achievement simply. When AI is everywhere, every process can be automated and accelerated. 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 UiPath, the AI everywhere foundation of innovation.
Did you know Bridgestone developed a tire using 75% recycled and renewable materials? Making a difference today for future generations. That's what really matters. Bridgestone, solutions for your journey. Visit whatreallymatters.com to learn more.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. News of big, interesting advances in the battle against HIV/AIDS last week. Three pieces of news. A second infected baby apparently cleared of HIV by early aggressive treatment. Monkeys protected against infection by long-lasting injections. And genetic engineering trials providing tantalizing evidence of what might someday even be a cure. Where are we in preventing, treating HIV/AIDS? And what's on the horizon? This hour On Point advances in the AIDS battle. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you following the developments in the treatment and prevention of HIV/AIDS? Do they give you hope? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Baltimore, Maryland, is Dr. Deborah Persaud, pediatric infectious disease specialist at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. She led the testing and was lead author on the reports of the two infants, one in Mississippi, one in California, who now appear to be clear of HIV after early treatment. Dr. Persaud, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
It's exciting to hear cleared of HIV, and some are even saying cured. We'll talk about what that might mean. Could you just introduce us to these two infants and their families, their mothers? 3 years ago, it was in Mississippi. Who was the mother? Who was the baby? What happened?
So the first case, in the case of the Mississippi child, this was an infant who was born to a mother who had not received prenatal care.
Okay.
And therefore was not receiving the antiretroviral drugs that we commonly use to prevent infection.
Meaning she had was HIV positive but wasn't receiving treatment?
So mother was actually diagnosed during the delivery process as mm-hmm. having HIV infection. So her infection status was not known at the time of delivery. It was found out during the course of delivery. And after that, the child was transferred to the University of Mississippi Medical Center, where she was cared for by Dr. Hannah Gay. And for management of these infants who are high risk or higher risk for HIV infection because their mothers have not received drugs to prevent infection, commonly what's done is more than one antiretroviral drug are given to the infants to prevent infection.
Okay.
Because that really is our goal, is to prevent the child from getting infected.
Sure.
But in this situation, what was different is the pediatrician used a 3-drug regimen in a treatment dosing schedule rather than the dosages we would use for prophylaxis.
In other words, a heavier dose and an extra drug.
It's a higher dose and daily dosing of the drug.
Yeah, yeah.
Usually it's not given, the nevirapine is not given in a daily dosing regimen when we're thinking about preventing infection. It's given daily when we're thinking about treating the infection.
And as I understand, what happened here was then the baby got this treatment but then sort of fell off the screen, disappeared from care, and when the Mississippi baby came back onto the doctor's screen, there was no HIV.
That's correct. So the child did fall out of care at around 18 months of age. Before 18 months of age, the child had intensive follow-up by Dr. Hannah Gay with monthly viral load measurements, which is what we use to monitor response to treatment. And the child had shown very good response to treatment with good control of the virus. But after falling out of care between 18 months and 23 months of age, the caretaker reported not giving any of the antiretroviral drugs. It was very surprising to Dr. Gay when she repeated the viral load at 23 months of age that there was no detectable virus in the bloodstream of the infant. And this prompted the investigation that we started, which was done in collaboration with, this is actually a team effort. It was myself, Dr. Catherine Lazuriaga of the University of Massachusetts Medical School, and Dr. Hannah Gay. And so it was very surprising that there was no detectable virus off antiretroviral treatment. We know from treating many children with HIV infection and many infants that when you stop therapy, there's quick rebound of the virus. And in this case, this did not occur. Now, we were actually in the process of planning a clinical trial to test this very treatment approach in infants. That is, whether if you give treatment very early, as in the Mississippi case, within the first 48 hours of life, could we achieve this clearance of the virus with very early treatment where the infants could eventually go off treatment and not have the virus come back? So this is the working definition of achieving what we're calling remission of HIV, where an infected child or person is known to be infected, receive an intervention such as in the Mississippi child, very early antiretroviral treatment, and that treatment is time limited, and with discontinuation of the treatment, there's no rebound in virus.
I mean, it's interesting. If that infant had stayed in under medical care, I guess ethically you would not have been free to withdraw the treatment. But because the mother just kind of vanished with the child for a while, it was in effect withdrawn, which allowed you to discover this remission.
That's absolutely correct. We would not, in standard clinical practice, stop antiretroviral treatment. Once a child is started on antiretroviral treatment, the treatment is lifelong. With effective treatment, these children live to 20 or 30 years of age, and so it is lifelong. But that's correct. It's really serendipity. The mom stopped antiretroviral treatment, and then with follow-up, we discovered, really, that there was no rebound in virus.
Now that child in Mississippi is 3 years old, still virus-free, and here comes another case, this one in Long Beach, California. What happened there, doctor?
So the second case is very different. First, I will say the Mississippi child is now about 3.5 years of age and has been off treatment now nearly 2 years. So clearly a continued remission from the first in this first case following the very early treatment intervention. The second case is different, and it's different because the child remains on antiretroviral treatment. And so whether this child has been placed in remission by the very early treatment needs to be determined. But what's happened in the second case is, like the Mississippi child, this was a high-risk infant in that the mother was not receiving antiretroviral treatment. Although this mother was known to be HIV infected, was prescribed antiretroviral drugs, she was not adherent to the antiretroviral treatment regimen. And again, this is a situation where an infant is at very high risk for HIV, for acquiring the infection. And here the pediatrician or the infectious disease expert in L.A. County, Dr. Audra DeVecas, decided to use the Mississippi baby's treatment regimen to see if she could identify or achieve the same outcome as in the Mississippi child. So starting at 4 hours of age, the second infant in Long Beach, California, was started on a three-drug regimen for prevention and then with the hope of treatment if the infant was indeed infected. Where we are now with the second case is that at the last follow-up visit in which we studied the infant, the child was 9 months old at the time, and it's very difficult to detect replicating virus within the bloodstream of the infant or any traces of HIV nucleic acid in the infant's blood. But that child remains on antiretroviral treatment. So we cannot say that this child has been in remission, but certainly early treatment prevented dissemination of the virus in this child and establishment of reservoirs at the point that we can detect using or standard approach.
Dr. Persaud, people are using, and it's sometimes sort of in quotes or air quotes, the word cure of HIV/AIDS around these two cases. Is that an appropriate word in your view?
I don't think this is an appropriate word at this time point. Cure requires much longer follow-up. And certainly in the second case, we need to have the child go off therapy to be able to assess whether we've even achieved remission. So thank you for giving us the opportunity to clarify the terms here. The only patient we know to date who has been cured of HIV is the Berlin patient through bone marrow transplantation.
Now,
these cases are remission, not cure.
So I'm looking at the significance of this. Not that many babies, infants, are born in the United States with HIV infection, but globally there are a lot. Is it possible that this treatment might be applied around the world to knock those infants' cases into remission?
I would say we still have cases within the United States. Actually, there are nearly 150 new cases every year in the United States. So this approach, if it turns out to be correct, has applications for infants within the United States.
Yep.
But you're correct. From a global standpoint, it's for the 250,000 new infections we currently have now globally, there is this has a potential to eliminate HIV infection in children worldwide.
That's a big deal. That's a 250,000 people a year, infants, who wouldn't have to carry it for life.
That's correct. If the approach shows to be effective.
Would it be economical? Would it be doable overseas in Africa, let's say?
I think it would be both economical and doable. The PEPFAR program has really demonstrated that we're able to provide antiretroviral treatment to individuals living in resource-constrained settings. Certainly, it has affected survival, morbidity, and mortality. So it's certainly feasible in terms of economical. When you think about this is lifelong treatment for an HIV-infected child, it certainly is economical.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about babies cleared of HIV and advances in the treatment and prevention of AIDS. We've been talking with Dr. Deborah Persad, joining us from Baltimore, pediatric infectious disease specialist at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. She led the testing of the two infants who now appear to be clear of HIV. With us as well right now from Bethesda, Maryland, is Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the National Institutes of Health. His institute funded the research into the treatment given to those two infants. Dr. Anthony Fauci, thank you very much for being with us today.
Good to be with you.
Put this in context for us. How do you describe the significance of what has happened with these two babies?
Well, it's really quite important. We need to have a clinical trial which is already being developed to really determine if this is reproducible in a large number of infants. The importance of it is the fact, as Dr. Persaud had just said quite correctly, is that generally when we're dealing with a high-risk infant who's born of an infected mother, particularly a mother who may not have had treatment during pregnancy, you tend to give a prevention type of a treatment until you can document definitively whether or not the baby is infected. That is not as aggressive or as effective, likely, as a full-blown treatment regimen immediately or as soon as you possibly can after birth. And the reason that the field of pediatric medicine and HIV has done that was because you want to balance the risk versus the benefit, in the sense of you don't want to be treating a baby who's not infected for a period of time with a relatively aggressive, potentially
right,
toxic drug regimen.
Mm-hmm.
Because generally, at least in the United States, where you have a lower risk of transmitting to the baby in a situation that we just saw here, that was a high risk because the mother wasn't treated. So you always want to balance the risk benefit. Now, when you show that you could possibly cure a baby if you treat them very quickly after birth, in the first baby within 30 hours, and then in the California baby literally within 4 hours, that you do have the possibility of a cure, which means that hopefully at some point in time you'd be able to successfully withdraw therapy, as was happened with the Mississippi baby, and the baby would go for an indefinite period of time without needing therapy. So it really changes the equation of the risk-benefit. So these two are very striking cases, but they bring up the impetus now to do a study to see if the benefit of being quite aggressive right from the get-go when a baby is born of an infected mother would outweigh the risk of potential toxicity to the baby if the baby turned out not to be infected. So these are really very important cases because they open the door to a whole new approach to treating babies who are born of infected mothers.
Curing babies born with HIV infection is a big, big deal in itself. If you could pull that off, if you could confirm that that's what was going on here, people are going to wonder, does this have broader application? Could anything that's going on in this treatment also be applied to adults with HIV infection?
In some respects, yes, but in other respects, unlikely. And let me explain what I mean. Most of the adults that we treat for HIV infected are infected for variable but sometimes considerable periods of time before they come under treatment. And what happens is that after a person, for example, the patients that I see very often might be infected for a few years before they even realize they're infected. They come in, and by that time, the virus has established what we call substantial reservoirs of the virus. Mm-hmm. And even if you put these people on therapy, as we do with many of them, and successfully suppress the virus to the point where people are leading normal, healthy lives with a potentially normal lifespan,
yeah,
you don't eradicate the virus from the reservoir because it's very, very difficult if that virus has established itself over a period of time. In contrast, with the infants we're talking about who generally get infected at the time of birth, passing through the birth canal, mm-hmm, not always, but most of the time, mm-hmm, what happens is it's unlikely that the reservoir is able to get established substantially so that when you start treatment within the first 20, 30, 48 hours of therapy, you get a really important head start on the virus. So although this may have some applicability to adults, because most adults don't get treated so soon after initial infection, it might not be completely applicable to adults.
Still, it's thrilling to imagine that you might be able to spare those children, those infants, a lifetime of HIV infection and the threat of AIDS. Questions for each of you, if I may go to them. Saad is calling from Los Angeles, California. Saad, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
The question for the panel is, as we know, certain viruses can stay in a human body dormant for many years, like the chickenpox virus, and then it can come back years later as shingles. Do we know that in the child, especially the one that is in Mississippi, if there is any possibility that the viral material is not laying dormant in, like, the lymph nodes? And the other question is, the cells that are usually infected in HIV are called CD4 cells, which are lymphocytes. Does that child have normal CD4 counts after the remission?
Dr. Persad, Saad wondering, could they be dormant somewhere in lymph nodes maybe? And what about CD4 levels? You'll have to explain that to us, doctor.
I'll answer the second question first. So the major target for HIV is indeed CD4 positive T cells. And its decline is a marker of disease progression. In the case of the Mississippi child, who's been followed very carefully by Dr. Hanagay, the CD4 levels have remained normal. With respect to the second question and the analogy to chickenpox or having dormant infection that then reactivates, in the Mississippi child, we're unable to detect dormant infection that is capable of replicating. But I will say that we've done serial testing on the infant, and we have found minute traces of the virus nucleic acid, or DNA, in the blood cells of the infant. Now, whether this signal is real or just due to noise based on the assays we're using is unclear, and certainly we're following very carefully. But to really summarize the effects, what we in our studies, we have not detected any dormant or, as Dr. Fauci referred to, reservoirs that are replication competent or capable of replicating in the child so far at 2 years of follow-up off antiretroviral treatment.
A very reasonable question, though, Saad, that long capacity for the virus to go dormant, I'm sure that'll be watched for a long time. Thank you for your call. Abby in Hartford, Connecticut. Abby, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I have a question for this pretty wonderful expert.
Mm-hmm.
Before we had testing, clearly newborns were sometimes sadly transfused with HIV-positive blood. And a large group of those patients were young newborns who had cardiac surgery. One of the things that's unique about cardiac surgery in the newborns is that their thymus gland is literally taken out and thrown away. And the thymus gland is a reservoir for T cells. Is there something about the unique immune system of the newborn and the role of the thymus gland that may be playing a role in all of this? And do any of you know of any evidence whether taking away the thymus gland had created a problem for children who may have been transfused? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Abby. Dr. Fauci, may I put that to you?
Sure. Well, first of all, the baby's immune system, the thymus is an important source of T cells where they undergo process for ultimate maturation. So the thymus gland is a very important gland. But notwithstanding that, the infant, the newborn infant, has an immature immune system that takes a certain period of time to mature. In fact, that could work to the favor of a baby who's HIV exposed and high risk and even infected, because it is conceivable, and there's some suggestive evidence, that the cells that form the reservoir for HIV are certain types of cells that are not the predominant cells in a newborn. And this hasn't been exactly proven yet, but there's good suggestive evidence that perhaps one of the reasons why, besides the rather immediate therapy that was given to these babies, one of the reasons why the reservoir may not have been formed and why it looks like these babies could possibly be cured is that the immaturity of the immune system did not provide in an overwhelming way the kinds of cells, those memory CD4 cells that are the major cells of the reservoir. So that difference in the immune system of a baby may actually work in favor of the baby in an HIV-infected situation.
Fascinating to get into it at this level of intimacy with the cells at which you work, at a very important level. Here we're talking infants, questions beyond that as well. Jeff in Boston. Jeff, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm well. What's your story or question?
Well, I just turned on the radio and I heard this. It was very interesting to me. I was diagnosed HIV positive about 10 years ago.
Okay.
And I was told I was a very interesting case because I apparently had been infected for only about a week or two because I hadn't developed any antibodies.
Wow, fast.
And I'm wondering, and they put me on antivirals immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering what my situation has to do with what they're talking about, what you're talking about today.
I mean, do you find yourself wondering if at some point, because they caught it early, you went right on. Could you get off the antivirals and be in remission?
Yeah, exactly.
Dr. Fauci.
Well, the answer is, of course, that's possible. The earlier, and that's one of the reasons why the baby studies are so important. We know from adult studies that when you do treat people very, very early, adults who are infected, like the caller who was treated within a very relatively short period of time, that there is a much greater chance that if you ultimately discontinue therapy after a period of time, that that person will not rebound with their virus. In fact, there have been a couple of studies, one from France called the Visconti study, in which a group of individuals were treated very early in the course of infection, and several of them had their therapy discontinued. Some of them rebounded, but there was a small number who did not, much greater number than you would expect from the normal, relatively small fraction of people who can control their virus without therapy. There was another study that's ongoing now in Thailand with similar results. So the bottom line is that the chances of a person, an adult, who's infected and gets treated within a week or so of the actual infection, even before the antibody response comes in, the chances of their actually having control of the virus following the discontinuation of therapy is much greater than if a person doesn't start treatment for months, if not years, after the beginning of the infection. And so clinical trials are actually ongoing that are going to carefully, in a controlled way, so not to cause any harm to the patients, ask and hopefully answer that question, whether when you withdraw therapy from people who have been treated very early, whether they can ultimately control the virus in the absence of therapy.
Dr. Persad, I can imagine our caller, Jeff, listening very carefully there. Is it possible, Dr. Persad, to, in his case, if he's not in a clinical trial, they caught it early, they began to treat it very quickly, can he test to see if it's in remission at the same time that he's continuing to have treatment? Is that possible, Dr. Persad?
I think we don't quite know yet how to determine who can be considered to be taken off treatment irrespective of time of starting therapy. Mm-hmm. And as Dr. Fauci said, you know, careful studies are needed to be able to identify which patients can safely go off treatment without experiencing rebound in the virus. And of course, concerns for acute retroviral syndrome.
So
I would say at this point, we really don't have enough information to be able to say in adults who can, and even in children who can go off treatment, even if it becomes difficult to detect existing viral reservoirs in patients like Jeff using our standard methods right now. And this highlights really the need for studies to begin to assess in a systematic way which patients can safely go off treatment. So I would say at this point, we don't have an answer
Jeff,
in terms of who can go off treatment.
Yeah, to our caller, Jeff, though, watch this space, some maybe more than a glimmer of hope there. Really interesting. We're going to hear in just a moment from Dr. Bruce Levine, who's been doing gene editing. This is beyond infants. This is in adults trying to get into the genetic formula and see if it can be changed in individuals to, here again, the word cure comes out. Dr. Fauci, are we seeing progress on the potential cure in adults as well? We'll hear in a moment directly from Dr. Levine, but do you see an appropriate use of that word on this genetic front?
Well, we've got to be careful when you use the word cure, because that's really the end result of the kinds of studies now that are making progress, but we're really not there yet. So those of us in the field are hesitant to use the word cure, but the studies that you're going to hear about the gene editing, are really very elegant studies that are important steps in the direction of conceivably being able to do that. We still have a long way to go, but the studies themselves are really quite impressive.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about babies cleared of HIV and advances in the treatment and prevention of AIDS, including what's being called gene editing. We'll hear in just a moment about that. Dr. Anthony Fauci is with us from the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the National Institutes of Health. Dr. Deborah Persad is with us from Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. She's been deep in the study of a couple of infants now found to be cleared or in remission who were born with HIV infection. Joining us right now from Washington is Dr. Bruce Levine. He is director of the Clinical Cell and Vaccine Production Facility at the University of Pennsylvania, associate professor there. He co-authored the study published in the New England Journal of Medicine last Wednesday that describes using gene therapy to battle, here again, the cure word gets raised, HIV. Dr. Levine, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for having me on to discuss our work.
What did you do in this so-called gene editing?
Well, let me tell you what the goal was. It was to engineer HIV resistance into a patient's own cells in the laboratory and then give them back to the patient like a blood transfusion. But the story really begins in the early days of the HIV epidemic with a medical mystery, and that was there was a very small cohort of people who were known to be repeatedly exposed to the virus and yet remained uninfected. Mm-hmm. And it was later discovered and reported in a flurry of papers that there was a co-receptor on the surface of T cells, CD4 T cells, that HIV needs to get inside.
Mm-hmm.
And there was 1% of people that harbor a naturally occurring mutation in the gene that codes for this receptor. So because the receptor wasn't present, HIV could not get inside cells. So in thinking about therapies, one looks first to stop it at the source, and that is described by Dr. Broussard's work with giving drugs early on.
And do most of us, if I may ask, have no resistance to the HIV virus?
Well, so that's a good question. Now, about 1% of people have two copies of the gene with this mutation, one from their father, one from their mother. But there are about 8% of people that have one copy of this mutation. Now, they can be HIV infected, but it seems as if they have a slower progression to end-stage disease.
So 90% of us or more have zero resistance, but then there's this 8%, and then there's the 1% that's sort of golden. What did you learn from them that you're now applying?
Well, so we began trials growing T cells from HIV patients in the mid-90s before doing gene therapy. And we were approached about a decade ago by a company called Sangamo in California, who said that they had developed a technique to specifically edit a gene, that is one gene out of the 25,000 in the human genome, and disable it or potentially correct a copy of a gene. And we began to work on this with NIH funding, mm-hmm. And this is the Integrated Preclinical Clinical Program that Dr. Fauci's Institute provides funding for. And we began to do preclinical studies to see if we could get this to work. And at first, it was very low efficiency, and we made some improvements, and we got it to a level where it would be feasible to bring into the clinical setting. And we initiated our clinical trial in 2009 and, as you mentioned, published last week.
Mm-hmm.
So again, the goal was to remove the patient's own white cells from their blood, bring them into the laboratory, and use a enzyme, zinc finger nuclease, to target this CCR5 gene, grow the cells up, and then we infuse 10 billion of those cells back to the patients. So what we're looking for is first, safety and feasibility. This is a first-in-human study, and that's always the paramount goal. But then could we detect the cells, the gene-modified cells? Were they expanding? And in fact, they were. And they first were infused to the blood and trafficked to the mucosal tissues, the site of infection. And then to look at the potential for a antiviral effect, what was designed into the trial is a very common practice used to evaluate HIV drugs, and that is to, under very careful supervision by the patient's physician, discontinue the patient's anti-HIV drugs.
And what did you find in that? Were you able to engineer this repelling virus quality into these cells?
Well, yes, we did. So that was shown in our preclinical studies and in the animal studies that we did. And we were able to successfully generate those cells in the laboratory and infuse them.
And were you able then in the infected patients, were they able to pull off of their therapy and stay free of the, have their own cells take over the resistance effort?
Well, that's the idea in the long term. Now, again, this is a first-in-human mm-hmm. study, and we're looking very carefully at the safety and feasibility. So this 12-week structured drug treatment interruption is an opportunity to look for the possibility of an antiviral effect. This is after discontinuing the drugs at about the 2-week time point, patients rebound. They have a viral rebound, and it comes back to the level that it was before the patients went on their antiretroviral drugs.
And then the HIV count bounces back. It's higher again.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
So you look for either a delay beyond 2 weeks or a decrease compared to what's called their historical viral set point.
And what about with your genetically edited load of cells in there?
Yeah, so then what you look for is there a difference in the persistence of the gene-edited cells that are protected compared to all the other cells.
Mm-hmm.
And first, with regard to the virus, we did see in a couple patients a decline in their viral load. And in one patient, at the very end of the treatment interruption, his virus went to undetectable. Now, when we looked at the relative presence of the gene-edited cells compared to the non-edited cells, it appeared that the gene-edited cells had a selective advantage, which is exactly what one would predict based on the preclinical studies.
So the New York Times summary of this was that in theory, if enough cells could be engineered, as you're doing, to repel the virus, patients might no longer need antiviral drugs and might, in effect, be cured. Does that look possible to you, Dr. Levine?
Well, we're a long way away from that, but this is a very important step. And again, as I think you mentioned earlier, cure is a loaded word. We think of it as a four-letter word. We don't like to use it.
And I'm quoting the Times here. You quickly get under that turf when you talk.
So I think it's more useful to think of a functional cure or think about people living healthier so that they would not be susceptible to the types of opportunistic infections that advanced HIV comes with, that perhaps some people may be able to discontinue their drugs, but again, we need to do further studies to establish that.
Dr. Persaud, as you listen to Dr. Levine's research here on adults with the HIV infection, what's coming to mind for you? Are you thinking about your infant studies and whether there might be some intersection here? How young could we do genetic editing? Is that purely an adult treatment? Is it relevant to your work, Dr. Persaud?
It's certainly relevant to our work in that many of our kids who are treated effectively survive to become young adults. And so this approach definitely has implications for the many more children or adolescents who are living with HIV. So it certainly has implications for pediatric and adolescent care.
Let me go to John in Gloucester, Massachusetts. John, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Don. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
So I'm a recently infected within just the past year.
Okay.
And I was a bit naive about things like PEP for like the morning after if you thought you came in contact. So I've been following all this new research. One of the clinical trials that I've been following closely other than the monkey vaccine was the activation of latent cells in the body with like cancer drugs. In order to just activate the latent cells and then allow the antiviral medications to keep killing off the virus once it's been activated again. And what I didn't know, or what it sounds like, is that you guys have the ability to actually assess a person's reservoir. And I was wondering if you could shed light on it is that you're going about assessing a person's reservoir. So that way, like, say you did a treatment, you got some of your reservoir activated, maybe 20% of it activates, they kill that off, you reassess, and you're like, all right, so it looks like you're about 80%.
John, let us jump in there. I mean, clearly you and many others are paying very close attention here. I want to try and respond to that. Dr. Fauci, first of all, this issue of sort of flushing out or a latent reservoir of cells to know what's there to be dealt with. And then this is the third element just in the last week. Our caller mentions what he calls the monkey vaccine. I want to go there as well. But first, about sort of how good are we now at peering deep in and figuring out, you know, when these cells are dealt with?
Well, a number of attempts, including by my own group here in, at the NIH in Bethesda, have attempted to what we call flush out the reservoir by activating the cells and seeing that while you're on antiretroviral therapy, if the cells start spitting out the virus, they'll die and the antiviral drug will prevent the virus that's being spit out of the cells from infecting other cells. Unfortunately, at this point in time, that has not been successful. Attempts have been made to activate and flush out, and then as it turns out, the reservoir is so deep-seated that you never flush out the entire reservoir so that when you stop therapy after that, the virus is still there. So that's certainly not ready for prime time. It's an area of intense investigation, but up to this point, it has not been successful. The idea of assessing the size of the reservoir is really a very imprecise science. The general way to look at the reservoir is to take, for example, in someone who's been infected and on antiretroviral therapy where there's no free virus circulating in the plasma, to take cells out of those individuals and examine in the CD4 cells just how many of those cells are infected and hence are a reservoir. That can give you a rough estimate of the size, but since there may be so many other body compartments that you don't have access to, such as the lymphoid tissue as opposed to the circulating CD4-positive T cells, that it's really very imprecise in giving an exact relative size in the reservoir of one person versus another person.
And go, if you would, Dr. Fauci, to John mentioned what he called the monkey vaccine. This was also in the news last year. I don't know about the word vaccine, but but this is a kind of a treatment, a shot that would help prevent disease period. Describe what we learned.
Well, Tom, it's not a vaccine at all. It is, it's a pre-exposure prophylaxis with an injectable, long-acting antiviral drug.
And this would be for someone who was concerned that they might be exposed in the future to HIV?
Indeed, a high-risk person who is not infected. Now, the reason why this injectable in the monkey study, and it came from a group in New York, David Ho and his colleagues at the Aaron Diamond Research Center in New York City, the reason it's important is that we know from studies, several studies that we have funded and others have performed, where when you give a pill a day of an antiretroviral drug, if people take the pill, it's highly effective in preventing the acquisition of infection. It can be as high as 90%+. However, given human nature and the fact that people don't adhere and like to take a pill every single day, when you look at the entire study, it was only about 40%+ effective. The reason the monkey study is important, it was shown that you could potentially give an injectable drug just every few months, namely 3 or 4 times a year, if you project the monkey studies to a human, so that a person does not have to be taking a pill every day. So if you could increase the adherence to this regimen, you might have really very effective pre-exposure prophylaxis. And that was what that monkey study was about.
It's interesting. You say it is not a vaccine, and that's quite true. But you hear how it's, the generic sort of vernacular that our caller uses for it is monkey vaccine, because you take a shot and you're protected against HIV.
Yeah, well, the trouble is that in a vaccine, you're inducing the body's own response to protect you. Mm-hmm. Whereas with the pre-exposure prophylaxis, you're administering a drug, and it's the drug that's protecting you.
I'm looking at, we've got all this news here from Dr. Persaud, from Dr. Levine. You're looking at this as well. I'm looking at the latest numbers that I see here from the CDC, more than 1.1 million people in the U.S. living with HIV, 13 years and older, including about 1 in 6 of those, almost 200,000, who do not know they're infected, 50,000 new infections a year. Where do you see all this research intersecting with that reality, Dr. Fauci?
Well, that's an excellent question. One is the research for the discovery of new interventions, and what the numbers you're telling us is the need to implement those interventions, particularly in the form of prevention. For example, you mentioned very appropriately that of the 1.1 million people who are infected in this country, about 16 to 18% don't know they're infected. Yet, about 55% or more of the new infections that occur each year come from people who don't know they are infected and who infect others. Mm-hmm. So if we could implement voluntary testing in a very aggressive way, getting people identified who are infected, put them on therapy, and we know from studies that if you put someone who's infected on therapy and get their viral load to below detectable level, you can decrease by about 96% the likelihood that they're going to infect someone else. So the research is important, but we've got to implement what we've got.
Important in this country and globally on a very high scale. I want to thank all three of you. Dr. Deborah Persad at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, thank you for your research, for your close attention to this, and for sharing it so well with us today. Thank you, Dr. Persad.
Thank you.
And Dr. Bruce Levine at the University of Pennsylvania, his piece last year in the New England Journal of Medicine on gene editing here, co-author of that. Dr. Bruce Levine, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Anthony Fauci at the National Institutes of Health, it's always good to talk with you. Thank you for your explanations and your insights today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be with you.
Listeners, lots of comment at our website, onpointradio.org. Check it out, and thank you for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.